All right, everybody, we're going to go ahead and get started here. My name's Steve Parr. I'm the Assistant Director for the American Homebrewers Association, and I'm just here to introduce our speaker for the afternoon. Our talk today is CO2, Everything You Always Wanted to Know But Were Afraid to Ask, with David Currier. David is the safety manager for Bell's Brewery. His career of over 25 years has included leading the health and safety program for a major dental products manufacturer, managing the occupational health program at an international risk management consulting firm, and sustaining the safety, health, and environmental activities of the world's largest printing, ink, coatings, and pressroom consumable manufacturer. He is a member of the Brewers Association Safety Subcommittee and past chairperson of the Michigan Safety Conference's Industrial Hygiene and Healthcare Division. He holds a Master of Science in Occupational and Environmental Health from Wayne State University and a Bachelor of Science from Madonna University with a dual major in Occupational Safety and Health, as well as a Fire Science Protection and minor in Emergency Medical Services. He is a certified industrial hygienist as well as a certified safety professional.
You got it, Steve.
Well, everybody, please join me in welcoming David Currier.
Thanks, everybody. I'm glad everyone's still with us on this really, really sunny, beautiful Wednesday afternoon as we get into this. CO2 and everything you're afraid to ask. The ask part's real important. We're going to hold questions to the end. If you have a question, we ask you to come up to the microphone in the center aisle here so everyone can hear it and we can have it well recorded for future prosperity and that. Where'd the clicker go? So what brought you in here was this little blip of a description. Three things I want you to concentrate on as we go along. The first one is anticipation. We want you to be able to anticipate where in your brewery you may find CO2. There's a few little hiding places that we're going to point out. The next thing is recognize. Recognize what operations within those areas generate the CO2. Recognize some signs and symptoms of CO2 exposure. So when you're doing your own HAZCOM training for your staff, you can communicate this information. We're going to spend very little time on these first two parts. The third part, managing the hazard. That's where we're going to spend most of our time. So before we dig in this all the way, a couple of little housekeeping issues. The first one is, if for some odd reason we do have a fire emergency, if you go back directly out your main entrance, you came in and hang a right, you'll see the stairway. That is our emergency exit. Our secondary exit is through the door here. You dump into another conference room and follow it out, and you can see the stairs. Vegas rules apply to this session. We're going to do a little survey at a couple different points, show of hands. Don't hold it against or for anyone, but at the same time, kind of look around and see where people are. We're going to use that as a networking opportunity for the rest of this week. So you can say, hey, they've already stumbled down this road, and they've tried this type of control method or that control method, and I may be able to talk to them and learn a little bit. Why should we be concerned? This is about the only time I'm going to get up on my soapbox. The national news has figured out what's happening with CO2. This is out of the Houston Chronicle, specific to our industry. And lastly here, OSHA's figured us out. We're popular. We want people to know about craft beer and everything else. Well, OSHA reads the news too, and they're following on and catching up with us. This is not the reason any of us should be monitoring our CO2 and watching it. We should be working and looking out for our employees. We should really be concerned about what's happening in our work environments here. The couple interesting ones on this one is this is a willful violation. So that means the employer knew and still did something wrong. The other piece of it is it's the general duty clause. General duty clause are more difficult for OSHA to enforce because it's a very generic phrase. It's not a specific black and white rule. So this means somebody screwed up pretty big. So what is this CO2? It's floating all around us right now as we sit here and breathe and enjoy our conference and stuff. Colorless, odorless, tasteless, and heavier than air. Remember, heavier than air. Colorless and odorless, most people go along with. Some people say, I can walk through my cellar space and I can smell it. You're really smelling your hops and all the other aromas and stuff that the yeast may be generating up in your beer, not actually the CO2 itself. The tasteless part, I had one of my cellar managers years ago say, hey, I can taste it. And I said, no, you can't. He goes, yeah, it's called carbonic acid. And it's really a tactile response, just like carbonic acid and CO2 in our finished product, is when it hits the mucous membrane, it changes from CO2 to carbonic acid. So there's a response there. You can sense it, but you're not truly tasting it. Heavier than air. It sinks to the floor. It likes to stay to the floor. we're going to use that for some of our control technologies. We will take advantage of a natural path that CO2 is taking and use it to our advantage. So here's our typical cellar space. Big or small, whatever your size is, it's set up more or less the same. This is what your CO2 looks like. Really, really heavy at the floor level. By the time we get up to the top of that bucket, 18, 20 inches or so off the floor, it drops down pretty quick. And by the time we get up to the breathing zone, we're back to a safe level. Breathing zone is safe from your shoulders to the top of your head. Kind of put a bubble around your face. That's your breathing zone. We're going to come back to this later on as we talk about some control technologies of how we can take care of this. My body, your body. One of the interesting things with CO2 is that's how our body drives its response to breathe. We measure the CO2 in our body, or my body takes care of itself and does it, and then it says I breathe more or less. Oxygen's not the driver. This is CO2 is the driver. So if I have an environment that's high in CO2 and I'm trying to get rid of my own CO2, it's doing nothing but increasing inside my body, and that's why we breathe harder and faster. CO2 is a simple asphyxiant. Simply means pushing the oxygen out of the way. That's why we use it in brewing. We use it to move beer from our keg to our tap. We don't want to use oxygen or air. That's a bad thing. So we use CO2 for that same reason. We're getting rid of the oxygen. Drowsiness, fatigue, reduced muscle response, these are all things that are normal to an elevated exposure or a high exposure. The muscle part and the fatigue or the drowsiness is one of the first things I've heard most people complain about. It's like, I'm slow, kind of in slow motion. My muscles aren't, they're not sore, but I'm just not responding like I should be, I normally would be. The increased heart rate and the shortness of breath goes back again to the fact that we're trying to get rid of the CO2 that from our own metabolisms in our body, and we can't because it's in our environment. It just keeps going up and up and up inside my body. So I breathe harder, I breathe faster, I change my rate of respiration. Then lastly, dizziness or headaches. Normally come a little bit later or a little higher exposures. The headache, again, is normally a secondary response. There's one beautiful thing, some fresh air. So if someone thinks they have a CO2 exposure and they're having some of these signs and symptoms, get them outside. That's all it's going to take. One of our control technologies in the administrative area is called a work-rest cycle, and it's basically giving your body time and fresh air to purge itself. And the same reason. Things, we just got to go through some terms and technology or exposure limits and stuff here. So time-weighted average. This is your 8-hour average. So you take all your highs, all your lows. I've been outside in fresh air. I've had a low exposure. I come back in some aspect of the brewery where the CO2 is higher. I average that out over my time. There's my time-weighted average. The next thing is a permissible exposure limit. This is the OSHA limit. So this is the legal limit for 8 hours that anyone can be exposed to. It's 0.5%. Short-term exposure limit, 15-minute average. So the time-weighted average or the permissible exposures for 8 hours, the short-term exposures for 15 minutes. It's a higher level. We're going on the concept that for 15 minutes I'd be at a really high level, but for the other 7 hours out of my day, it's relatively lower controlled. So on the average, we're okay. The last one is the immediately dangerous to life and health, LDLH. This is 4%. And we saw in that first picture, around that bucket where that tank was blown off, it was 4%. So on that floor level, if you had a maintenance guy working in there, someone down there scrubbing drains, they're in that 4%. They're in this immediately dangerous to life and health situation. So we got to control that. We got to get that CO2 out of there one way or another. If you buy a sensor, so if you went out and got you guys one of these, it's either going to display in parts per million or percent. And the same with the fixed units on the wall. So I wanted to give you a little bit of a relationship here. So the 5,000 ppm is 0.5%. That is our 8-hour allowable limit. For the most part, if you think 10,000, 1%, it's easy to do the math in your head after that point. Some common things. We start outside at about 400 ppm or about 0.04. We run inside. This is a very large room. This room has about 130,000 cubic feet in it. We can keep this room relatively flushed out with all of us in here without much trouble. We run in then and get into the OSHA limits, immediately dangerous to life and health, and so on. someplace down in this 4 to 5 range is your exhaled air. So if you get a sensor and you want to just check it to make sure it's working or at least responding to a COT, breathe on it. Just breathe on it. Give it a good puff. It'll work out real well for you. You won't get it. It's not there for accuracy. It's just to say, yes, I found CO2. I'm happy. I'm working right. This is a little plug. Everyone has a hazard communication program, correct? This is a little plug to remember to include CO2, both as the byproduct of your manufacturing process and as the tank and cylinder that you bought it from. Next area of recognizing where things are is locations. CO2 is everywhere. Some way, shape, or form, I suspect, it touches all aspects of your operations, be it a brew pub, be it a regular brewery, shipping and receiving, your lab, limited in the brew house. I want to talk about the three big ones here, packaging, pub, and cellar. Cellar, I think, is probably the most straightforward, where everyone's going to shake their head, yep, no problem, I got CO2 in the cellar. Yep, my buckets blow off like that too regularly, so, and I make small messes. Packaging, sometimes I think a little forgotten. The big guy here is the can line. Can lines, the whole idea is I'm flushing that whole seamer area of CO2, so that CO2's got to go somewhere, comes out right here with your cans, and then into your work environment. Bottles aren't too bad, and kegs are generally a seal-type system, so they're not generally an issue to be concerned with here. This is the other tragic, probably up on my soapbox a little bit. This came out last year from Michigan. We said CO2 is heavier than air. It likes to find low places. The other concern here is the fact that we get into the coolers themselves. It's a refrigerator. It's got a big rubber gasket seal around it. Its whole idea is to be airtight. You don't want to lose all that cold air you paid good money for to make the cold air. It's going to trap everything in there. So if there's a small leak, someone didn't get a keg hooked up correctly, we're going to have issues. When we talk about sensor technology, the other concern we have there is cold temperatures play havoc on sensors. So we got to find the right unit to work in that environment. Before we go in, and that's the first part, we're done with anticipation and recognition. So we're into the meat now. But before we get there, I want to talk a little bit about, as an industrial hygienist, we go through a process called the hierarchy of control. How are we going to eliminate these hazards? We have a specific process to go through. I'm going to look and I say, can I eliminate it? Can I substitute something less toxic? Are there lots of engineering controls I can try to use in there? We run down the line to PPE, which is the worst thing to do, the last thing you want to do. And it's generally the first place as humans we jump to. The last little point where it points down to is control at the source. So as close to the point of generation of that CO2 we can get, the better off our control technology is from a cost viewpoint, from a sustainability viewpoint, from helping our employees' workforce. So, quick show of hands. Hey, hold your hand up if you believe there's a way to eliminate CO2 from breweries. I've got one that comes close. I'm going to eliminate it probably from your workforce or your work environment a little bit. Substitution. Raise your hand if you believe there's something we can substitute CO2 for. Or with. What? Go ahead.
I have no idea.
Okay. Some people say nitrogen. Okay. Nitrogen is another simple asphyxiant. So part of our definition to make a substitution is it has to be less toxic. So it's a trade-off. And there. Engineering controls, yep, we got a lot of them. We're going to talk about 3 or 4 different ones. Administrative controls, again, there's lots to choose from. We'll be right on track with those two, and then we'll get down to our PPE. The other concept about controlling things is called the pathway. So that CO2 comes out of the vessel, goes across to your brewer. Whenever we can, again, we want to control it at the source as close as we can. As we step through these different control technologies, I'm going to show a similar slide. Just to see where we are in that path. Again, closer to the source, the faster we control it, the better off we're going to be. Control options, detections, evacuation, exhaust, dilution, administrative, and PPE. So we're going to run down this list in the next series here. Thing to remember is you're going to need more than one. At least something in administrative controls as a minimum. You may have two or three. You may have different ones in different operations. First one's detection. Lots of different sensors out there. This is an old one. Don't ask what the level is in here. This one doesn't work. It's a demo model and stuff. So, but they're really handy, the little portable ones like this, too. Then we got fixed units that bolt to the wall. They can do other work for us. Couple options when it comes to the science behind it, real quick. The first one's called a color detector tube or a length of stain tube. It's a little hand vacuum pump. It's got a little glass tube. Inside that glass tube is some beads that have been color or chemically treated, and they change colors when the CO2 is drawn down through them, and then you read the scale inside. It's going to run you about $400 to get started. The glass tube gets thrown away every time. You have to buy new of those. Very localized. I'm going to pump here, and it's going to take a sample, and that's it. Not real accurate. I'm not recommending this, but I'll let you know it's out there. If you see these used in reality in life, it is probably hazmat teams. They're wonderful for a hazmat team when they're doing quick samples on a rescue scene, on a spill somewhere. So what you guys want is infrared. This is the way to go. Two choices, portable units or fixed units, bolted to the wall. Handheld units, they're simple. Most of them are pretty much today, turn them on, turn them off. Do you have a confined space meter in your operation? You could add a CO2 sensor to your confined space meter as an option. Now I can do all my confined space gases plus CO2, which you should be doing anyway. Then, if I don't have an issue to enter a vessel, I can take that same unit and go out and do my CO2 monitoring someplace else in my cellar, my packaging area, down my pub cooler, wherever. So it's one way around it and still get a handheld. Great for job and task-specific things. This clips with me. It knows what I did. I'm dry hopping right now. I'm going to go over here next and purge out a tank. I'm racking something. It's with me. I know during the day what happens. These guys run anywhere from $300-$400 up to about $1,500. As you go up in technology, you gather some things. Probably data logging is the first thing you pick up, so this can record, so I can tell you what my time-weighted average is. The unit does it automatically. Punch it in there. I want to know, take me a sample every second. And then it's going to do all the math for you at the end of the day. Boom, here's your average. You have it. The other advantages or disadvantages, if you do this or even if you hire an outside industrial hygienist, a safety person, your insurance company to do it for you, watch where they put the sensor. I've seen people do this. I'm putting it in my shirt pocket. So I'm sitting here, I'm breathing out of my nose all day, working hard. Boy, I'm generating CO2. I just gave myself a false positive response. Don't want that. And trying to decide where's the best place to put this, I had another industrial hygienist suggest, well, let's clip it on the back of the shirt here. It's up in the breathing zone. It's above my shoulders and everything else. So I said, okay, we'll try that. Had my guys go in and do dry hopping. Got a question? Good point. His point was the response time of these units. It's up to 30 seconds. How far can you walk in 30 seconds? For me, I could probably get halfway through one of our large cellar space without any issues before the alarm goes off. Great point to be made. It's not perfect. It's really, really, really good. It's not perfect. So if we put the unit behind the head and we tried doing an 8-hour average, what we found out in dry hopping, when they open the top of the vessel to start dumping the top hops in, your head acted as a control technology. Their air came up around the head and went wherever, so we never saw it. So my recommendation, if you ever see someone try to do it, is the shoulder. Sensor coming forward on the shoulder. You're still up close enough to the breathing zone. You're not in your own exhaled air, and you're going to get a good response. They come with different clips. This clip obviously wouldn't work. The other thing to remember that your outside consultant probably won't do, if you've got anything up in here, put a lanyard on it. You don't want it falling down in your vessels. It's not an adjunct for beer flavoring. Breathing zone versus floor levels with handheld unit. Obviously, I can do my breathing zone. I can put it down on the floor. I can set it next to a bucket. I can set it next to my operation, a drain, wherever I want to use it. Because of the portability, it's really good. I can change the alarm settings. So if I know in my space, if I'm doing an 8-hour average and I want to make sure I alarm, and I got that 30-second response time, lower the alarm. It'll go off sooner, so you'll find out about it. They're going to need a little preventive maintenance. Any unit like this needs some calibration. The infrared technology in them is good for about 10 years. It's very rugged. The calibrations don't go off, go out of span too often. They quickly calibrate back to fresh air. So most of them got a bump test. I can say, I just go outside, fresh air. It knows it's around 400 ppm, and it's going to zero itself out. Fixed units. These are guys attached to the wall, permanent, more or less. So I got a standalone station, I got multi-points. The standalone station is, it's screwed to the wall, it alarms, it beeps in one location, right here. A multi-point station, I got this one that ties some kind of warning system, some kind of collection system that's tied to this one that goes back to that warning system that's in another room and comes back up. Much more sophisticated. Single point alarm does you other advantages. A lot of them can be tied into ventilation system and other alarm things. They've got a relay in them, up to a 240-volt relay, so they can trigger other devices to work at a given point. When we talk about controls, ventilation controls, we'll get into that a little bit more. Preventive maintenance is the same. The sensor technology is the same. A couple things to watch out for. You will go out online and find CO2 sensors that sell for under $100. Look at the range. If you get a unit that goes from 0 to 2,000 ppm, it's not going to do you much good. When you're going to blow way past it, you're never going to know. You're safely allowed, and I say use the word safely here, 5,000 ppm over an 8-hour average. You know from our other slides that you're going to find places well above it that you still need to know about. I'd recommend something that doesn't leave 0 to 5% or 0 to 50,000 ppm to give you that range of where you might be working in. Just thought of something. Back your brains up a little bit to the beginning of the slides. If you do a Google search for any of these tools or for carbon dioxide in general, be very, very careful. There's much, much more information on there on carbon monoxide. So Google, you'll find that and you'll start reading something. It's like, oh, this sounds interesting. This is really nasty. It's like, wow, my furnace is generating, carbon dioxide. No, it isn't. Your furnace is generating carbon monoxide. So there's a big difference. So just watch that verbiage when you do your Google search. And it may even autocorrect for you. So just keep an eye on it. Our first, I'll say, real control. We got to have detection. We got to know where the levels are right now, every day in our brewery. So that's our detection piece of it. So the next thing we're going to do is really dig into this and get an evacuation. So the evacuation is we're going to remove the CO2 before it ever leaves the vessel. Primarily used as fermentation. I think this is about as close as we can get to elimination because we never let it get out into the workplace in the first part. It's a very, very effective engineering. It is the most effective way to do this. A series of pipes or hoses. We're going to take the gas from fermentation vessels directly outside. You're going to most likely want a foam trap, and I'll show you why. And you make sure you got pressure relief, especially if they're up in the northern states. If you got your evacuation hose goes outside in the middle of winter, that week when it's like zero all week, you're going to have enough moisture in it, you got a good chance of freezing up that pipe, and then you're going to get back pressure. Don't want to blow up one of your vessels. For our visual learners, foam trap dumps water, sprays it down with water, dumps it down the drain, and the CO2 goes outside. For our sustainability folks, this is not the world's most sustainable use of water. And the guys in California, you'd really have to really crank that down and find the most effective way to do it. We've tried some defoamers. They're not real effective. We've just gone back to water. And I know Walker hates it, but works real well for me. So you think about the P-trap underneath your sink in your bathroom. Its design is to keep sewer gas down in the sewer. And it just holds a little bit of water. This is just literally the opposite. We're going to flush the liquids down, but we're going to capture inside this vessel the gas and send it outside. Now, for those who are thinking, I need this highly engineered design, beautiful system. It's like, wow, that's bigger than some of my fermentation tanks. I only make a couple thousand barrels a year. It's like, don't worry about it. This one's designed for a series of 800-barrel vessels. Yes, it's highly engineered. It's very effective and everything else. But do we have any do-it-yourselfers? You can make your own. It's easy. An old blue barrel and a couple of fittings. It works. It works. And that's the whole idea. It works. You could simply take generally your spray ball arm off the top of your vessel, run the hose outside, shove it out the window. Your CO2 is going outside. Your foam and rest of the mess. You got some housekeeping issues, but it works. And that's the whole idea, is getting that CO2 from my work, not allowing it to get in my work environment and getting it outside. So I said, if you have a foam, if you don't have a foam trap or your foam trap fails, you got issues. It makes for big messes. So, and no one likes to clean up too big a mess. And that is that highly engineered, well-designed, huge stainless steel foam trap you just saw because someone forgot to hook the pipe to it. So when it's working, it works real well. You're going to blow your CO2 outside through these evacuation lines. Someplace, you're going to have high CO2 on the outside of your building now. You're going to generate a hazard. Instead of letting it all off in your work environment for all your workers, you're going to put it outside. You may need some kind of warning. So this is kind of the pattern that you end up seeing, is that your discharge pipes, it's obviously highly concentrated. It thins out or dilutes itself as it spreads out. It's a pretty good picture in here. That's almost 30 feet across, and we're still above 2%. So at 2%, we're 4 times OSHA 8-hour limit. So it's still relatively really high. So at 5%, we're over immediately dangerous to life and health. So this is an area we used to have truck drivers just get out and stretch their legs a little bit and stand. So it's like, hey, yeah, got all the CO2 out of the cellar without we were doing a real good job. Caused ourselves another little headache that we had to deal with. Cost, huge variable here. If you go to the point where I want to put in stainless steel piping and a stainless steel foam trap and bring it outside and everything else, yeah, it could rack up pretty good. If I want just the blue barrel, some fittings on it, relatively expensive. If I want to just put my blow-off bucket outside, pretty cheap. I'm already doing that. I'm going to need a little length of hose. Consider, be thoughtful of cross-contamination and sanitation. Something's got to be clean. Cleanliness is so important to us as an industry. Just keep that in mind here. If you're running different yeast, that's one of the things we are concerned with, is cross-contamination of different yeast strains. Again, homemade or highly engineered, doesn't matter. It can be done either way. Anyone can use this method. Any size brewery can do it. Foam traps, I highly recommend, and watch where you put that discharge point outside. Shifting gears. Let's exhaust some of this air. We're letting the CO2 into the work environment now, but somehow we're going to grab it and blow it or suck it outside. So we're moving down as we move down that inverted triangle, we're getting less and less efficient at our control technologies here. So this is drawing air out. We're exhausting. It's less effective, but still effective, but not quite as effective here, engineering control. Is it sustainable? It can be. The general exhaust system, and we'll know the slide here, we're moving high volumes of air. It's kind of hard to be sustainable, but there's some ways we can do this. Localized is better. So the closer, again, to that point of generation I can get, the better off I am from a sustainability viewpoint, from a control viewpoint, and everything else. You're going to have some help designing this. You're going to need an industrial hygienist or a ventilation engineer, someone to help you design these to get it efficient and correct and do everything you want it to do for you. So basic exhaust system, we got a hood, some ductwork, a fan, and a stack. Air, and anything floating around in the air. It's very difficult for us to reach out and grab that contaminant, to grab the CO2. We are just the way nature is, we don't grab out real good. On the stack side, we can blow real hard. You think about a fan. So put a piece of paper on either side of a fan. If you put on the back side of that fan, I've got to come up to be a couple inches for that fan before that paper sucks up against it. If I go on the front side of that fan, I can be 10 feet, 20 feet away, and my paper still might be moving a little bit. So it's just the engineering process behind it here. Local exhaust ventilation, it's pretty limited. The examples I've here are drains and some packaging areas. It's the most effective means of exhausting because it's all localized. We need very little air to do it. Cost, it's going to be more costly because you got to design a hood. The hood's got to be designed properly. You got more duct work in your blower and stuff. It's going to have to be an engineered system. As I said, you'll need some help here. To help control your operating costs and your sustainability is tied in somehow with your piece of equipment. This is a drain off a centrifuge. So every time that centrifuge back flushes itself and blows out all the hops from dry hopping and stuff, a bunch of CO2 goes out that purge drain. We used a couple things here. One is CO2 is heavier than air. It's in the drain. It's already in a low spot. By putting the hood over it, we kept it in a low spot. Because we've enclosed it and we've entrapped it very locally at the source, it takes very little air. So this is the actual exhaust. This is where the air sucks out and goes outside. It takes very little air. Cleanliness. It's a messy operation. This happens to be stainless. So we can take that off periodically, flip upside down, and scrub it. As I said earlier, canning. Cans are great. No sunlight gets through there. There's no UV in them. They seal up real well. We purge this whole seamer compartment with CO2, so there's no real oxygen in there and everything else. So they're a great container from that side. Exiting with your cans is CO2. If we set our meter down here on this little ledge, that's 3-4% easily down here. Just pouring out of there as long as that machine's running. As soon as it stops canning, it turns itself off. It's pretty good. It's quick and easy. So this is during mock-up. These are the pictures I grabbed here. But we designed a hood to sit on the side there. So this is just a little local exhaust hood. It sits on the side. It draws very little air because all it has to do is reach across that conveyor line. It's about 6 or 8 inches. And we've pulled off all the CO2. The heaviest CO2 does get heavier in air, and one of my ideas, well, we can put something down in here, but there's enough liquid around potentially and mess that it became a housekeeping issue if we were down in that territory. So we said, nah, we'll go across the side. We realized we got to reach, but not real far to get that gas out of the way. But it works. General exhaust, much wider application. I can probably use general exhaust in any aspect or any part of the brewery or area. You want to make sure, again, CO2 is heavy. We're going to draw off the floor. We want that ventilation low, 8, 10, maybe 2 feet off the floor at the most, so we sweep against that floor. We're going to move large, large volumes of air. Not efficient, because all that huge volumes of air that I moved, I just paid to have it air-conditioned or heated. Now I'm going to suck it all out, and I've got to replace all of it. So from that viewpoint, it's not real effective. From the viewpoint that I can jump down a little bit here, tie this into one of my sensors or detectors and have that fan that sucks the air out turn on and off as my CO2 level changes throughout the day and the week and stuff, it becomes much more effective. So there's things we can do with it here. It's probably a lower cost than local exhaust. The components are simpler. The design really has to be a balancing. I'm drawing out all this air. I got to make sure I'm replacing all of it. So my makeup air system's got to be balanced with it. So this is makeup air in an open fermentation cellar. It comes in at 2 levels, and then it sweeps across the opposite corner of the room. So this is under negative pressure. There's a ton of air moving through here. During fermentation, we saw nothing in the air. There's so much air moving through here that ever came out. So, in there. So exhaust, yes, it's effective control. You're drawing air out of the space. You're not blowing air. You're sucking air. It's sustainable. Yep, the more local I can get or I tie it in to run only when I need it to run, I can be a sustainable way of dealing with this here. You're going to need help designing this type of system. This isn't something you can do. If I just shove an exhaust fan up on the wall, it's not going to do you much good. If you shove the exhaust fan down by the floor in the wall, you'll be better. You put some ductwork in there so it can draw across the floor or at high volumes and velocities, yeah, it's going to work here. So, stepping down our ladder, we're getting into this red zone now. Dilution. So the old saying, dilution is a solution. We're going to let it into our space. And we're going to determine at some point how much space do I need. So this is our least effective control measure, because it's only the fresh air that we're blowing in is our dilution factor. Maybe our space. If anyone wants to render a guess, if I remember my math right, how many barrels would have to be fermented simultaneously in this room to get us to 0.5% CO2 under perfect mixing conditions? Fine. Anyone? Fine. Okay, show of hands. Over 100. Over 500. Over 1,000. Over 2,000. Over 5,000. Over 7,500. Do I hear 10,000? Okay, I'm going to stop. It's 5,000. Give a bake. Rough math. This is, like I said, this room is 55 by 88 with 28-foot ceiling, according to the brochure on the conference center. So it's about 130-some-odd-thousand cubic feet. It's a big room. Who has a cellar this big? Who has a brewery this big? Yay, a couple of us. So it's like 4,700 square feet, so it's like four times the size of my house. So it's a big room. So, but it can be done. I could design a system in here just to bring in fresh air or give space that I'm diluting my CO2. And we'll talk about some other examples like that. So again, we're back to our little display here. We got 4% at the floor. We got 0.5% up in our breathing zone. I want to dilute it, and that's it. So if I bring enough fresh air into this room, even if I'm doing that 5,000-barrel fermentation, I'm going to be able to stay there. I can go up to 10,000 barrels and still stay at 0.5% by using space. We don't gain space. We don't have space. We do have fresh air, though. How do we get fresh air into our brewery? Through our ventilation system. Assuming you have a ventilation system, I'll let you do that. It's not common. It's one of those industrial things. It's got to be built into that system. For small spaces or small operations with large spaces and a detection system, this is an effective way to go. You can do it. The detection system is very important here. Don't use a fan thinking, I'm just going to put a fan in the corner and I'm going to blow the air across my CO2 and it's going to fill up the space in that. It doesn't work that way. There's not that natural perfect blending. You're going to come back here in this 4% at the floor, you're going to mix that up with the 2%. Now I got a 3% mixture maybe. How am I ever, now my 0.5% is probably up about 1% because all I did with that fan is stir it up. So we got to get rid of it or thin it out with fresh air. Your standard ventilation system is not designed to control CO2 from a point of generation, from a brewery's viewpoint. It's designed to control CO2 from me and you breathing all day. There's a more serious system that can control its speed, control how much fresh air will work. In one of our operations, we use dilution. We have a sensor. The sensor reads how much CO2 there is. It sends a signal up to the HVAC unit on the roof. Expensive system, but so I can change the speed of the fan, variable speed fan, and I can change how open the damper is on my fresh air. So as the CO2 level comes up a little bit, I speed up my fan, I open up my damper, and now I'm moving more fresh air into that space, and I'm keeping it diluted. But again, pretty sophisticated. Administrative controls, that control technology is all the way past our worker in these. And don't say, oh my God, that's bad. The whole idea is to contain the CO2. But we still need a lot of these. We still need policies and SOPs. If I've got a small operation, I've done my monitoring and that, and I've determined that, hey, I went in there on the first day I monitored, we're all high, and it's Tuesday, because Monday we do all our brewing, and Tuesday we've got everything in fermentation. It's starting to roll pretty good. Change your policy. Maybe we brew 2 days out of the week, so we only have half the amount of barrelage in fermentation at any given moment. So we've reduced the amount of CO2 that we're generating. Manual ventilation, i.e. open the windows and turn on a fan, even if it's drawn outside. Or it's a blower that'll go over and flip the switch. It may not be totally automated. It's an administrative procedure. It's got to be in your SOP. The first thing I do is turn on the fan. The second thing I do is turn on my piece of equipment. The third thing I do is I run my beer through it. Job rotation or work-rest cycles, I talked a little bit about these in the beginning. The fact that if I go outside in the fresh air, my body purges itself of CO2 and everything's better again. Again, with the help of an industrial hygienist, an OCC health person, you can go through and do this, do the calculations to say, hey, I ran out of all the other things. I want to make more beer. I haven't got, you know, my engineering controls perfect yet. Maybe if I take an extra 15-minute break every hour, I will be good because I'm going outside in fresh air and purging myself. With the help of those other professionals, you can do that type of calculation. Not the first recommended method, but it will work. You're going to have emergency action plans. There will be administrative education and training related to your hazard communication program and such. And now your preventive maintenance and things. So, the other part of administration will be knowing what is happening. Show of hands, who knows what the CO2 is in their building right now, in their brewery? Super. Next year, let's see if we can double that number. And you may have measured it last week or someone else, but at least you're looking into it. So, I see a smile or two out there, and I say, it's like, yeah, right, I'm going to spend $800 and buy one of these. Rent it. Ask your insurance company to do it for you. They may charge you, but again, they're going to bring in some people that are trained and educated to do it. There's plenty of consultants that are out there to do it, too. I would up to say, Matt's done consulting, too, and it's like I'd up to say when I was a consulting industrial hygienist, someone say, hey, this is John Doe Brewery. Will you come help us? And I said, yep, my rate's good still, but I'll be happy to come see you guys. So we're fun places to work at. So another aspect of administrative controls is, what do I do when the alarm goes off if I got an alarm? Just basic emergency evacuation, emergency control technologies. Last, at the bottom of that triangle, is personal protective equipment. It's the last place we want to be for any control technology, for any hazard. Our human nature goes to personal protective equipment. I can hold a respirator in my hand. I can put it at my face. It feels good. I feel like there's something there. I've got my safety glasses on. I got gloves on. It's the last place we want to go, but our human nature takes us there real quick. The downside is, for CO2, there isn't any real PPE. There's no way around. You're not going to, this is actually an old-time miner with a rebreathing system. We're not going there. We're not going to put everyone in SCBAs or air hose, but I guess you could. You get protests that way. That's the end of the control technologies and everything else. So let's look at this a little bit here. We wanted you to anticipate stuff. Anticipate the fact that, yes, CO2 is going to be in my brewery. We can't get rid of it. Anticipate it's going to be in every aspect some way or another. Recognize some of those signs and symptoms. Those grogginess, those heavy muscles, I'm feeling kind of sluggish today type of stuff. And then go through the controls, starting with the fact that I can't eliminate it, I really can't substitute it, I need to get in my engineering controls. And they're doable. The simple idea of taking the hose from your fermentation tank and sticking it out the window or having your blow-up bucket outside is very doable for any size operation. And probably more important, if you're in a tight building or a lower space, it's even going to be more important. Probably more important than that, the first thing I really want to encourage everything to do is go out and find where your levels are. Go out and do some measurements so we know exactly where you are. I think you'll probably be pretty amazed. I think most of us feel, it's CO2. It's not that big a deal. Skip the fact that a few people die from it, but I can deal with it. I'm a brewer. So, questions and answers. And we ask that you come up to the microphone. Crickets? No? No one? Oh, guests, don't get up yet. I'm prepared for this scenario. I have an emergency action plan. Let me ask you guys some more questions. Ask yourself this. What should I do when I get back? What should I do when I leave here? I want to encourage a few things then. We did a little bit of survey, a little bit of show and tell, or show of hands, so you know who's around you. We realize that most of us are not monitoring, and a few of us are. If you notice who is sitting around you that is monitoring, network with them. Hey, what kind of sensor did you buy? How much did you pay for it? Where did you put it in your brewery? Does it work? How much effort is it? What kind of response do you get with it? Do that networking. Who's got ventilation systems, exhaust ventilation systems in their operations? Whoa, much higher number without monitoring? So we've got constant airflow? Again, for us that haven't got down there yet, look at it. The biggest thing I want you to do is talk about it. It's my first mantra of risk management. Don't play ostrich. Just talk about it. Don't be afraid of it. The next thing is think about it as CO2 management, not control. When we manage something, we take an active approach to it. We recognize it's there, and we go out and reach out to it and say, hey, I'm going to take control of you. I'm going to do something and not respond to you, but I'm going to tell you, i.e. the gas, where to go in the first place. The last thing is it goes back to the word yet, and it's a journey. You looked around and said, oh, this guy's monitoring, these guys got ventilation systems, I haven't done anything yet. Well, now you can talk about it. You got a little bit of knowledge. It's your journey has started for you to dig into it. Contact information. BA likes us to have this. The other point I want to say, if you got questions, what time, do you know what room we're in tomorrow night? We'll look it up. Tomorrow evening, the BA Safety Committee, we're having our open house. Hey. Yep, here we go. Safety subcommittee, level 1, D-137. So there'll be half a dozen of us there, professionals. The brewery industry is blessed. We have, I believe, the highest number of certified safety professionals and certified industrial hygienists per business unit, dollar, cents, whatever, of any industry. That's because we like beer, I guess, as industrial hygienists. So you got a bunch of knowledge there. Questions?
Yeah, just wondering why you choose to monitor CO2 rather than oxygen content.
The biggest reason is looking at the gas itself. We know we're generating the CO2, so we want to cut it off before our oxygen goes down. The other reason being is I think it's the technology is easier on the CO2 than the oxygen. So, just a second. You can go to the mic, please.
Yeah. First of all, CO2 in itself is dangerous for the body. It's what controls the lungs and the heart. Mm-hmm. It's not the lack of oxygen. So if you mix 8% CO2 with the right amount of oxygen, you still die.
True.
So it doesn't have to do with the oxygen.
In your cellar spaces, you're in a truce, not in a cellar, excuse me, in a cooler. If you're running nitrogen, so if you're putting nitrogen on your stouts and stuff, you're going to want to do both. The big difference is with the oxygen, you're going to monitor the oxygen sensor. It's going to be bolted to the wall up in the breathing zone, and your CO2 sensor is going to be down by the floor because oxygen is everywhere versus CO2 is heavier than air. Thank you.
Make some comments about having a fermentation area close to a bar or tasting room area and how that CO2 might affect what's going on with patrons that are drinking?
Definitely. For me, be it a patron or be it an employee, it's a person that we need to protect, and I'd approach it the same way. I'm going to want to know what my levels are, probably do some monitoring out in that space away from the cellar itself or the fermentation blow-off buckets, etc., if it's an open space. But I look at it as a person who's exposed. Control technology, I go back to the same control technology. It'd be super. A lot of operations we see common is they put up the glass wall so everyone can see it, but we're separating the two spaces. Is there, again, timing? Could we use timing? It'd be difficult, I think, to say I'm going to time so I only have fermentation happening on the days of the week when my bar is slow. So, yeah.
What are your thoughts on a brewery that is a relatively open brewery, a lot of natural airflow with the CO2 being dispersed that way?
Okay. It can work. Do you know what your levels are? That's what you need. Yes. The big space like this, if you got yourself an old warehouse and you're set up in the corner of it, space can work in your favor. You're still going to have hot zones. So wherever that vessel is blowing off your bucket is, right around it, you're still going to have a hot zone. if you recognize it and realize it's there and you've measured it, you can probably control it that way.
Is there any risk factors that are different in like warm weather areas? Like, for instance, we're in South Florida. Does CO2 react any different in hot weather than it does in cold climates?
Not that I'm aware of. Temperature outside or humidity doesn't. You're going to be running the air conditioner, where us folks in Michigan and Minnesota, we're running our furnaces in the winter and stuff, so we still have a closed environment or building. So this is the opposite but the same.
For fixed monitors, two questions. Do you recommend locations? You mentioned near the floor. And then the second question is, for alarm set points, what do you recommend for those?
Most, about 18 inches off the floor is the standard location. And that alarm set points, most manufacturers are sending them out with 1 and 3. So 1% is the low-level alarm and 3% is the high-level alarm. That's become pretty standard, feel it, most of manufacturers. Again, you can reset that. In our operation, I've got two areas where I've got them set down to 0.75%, because I want to know it's my clean zone, and my cellar station is one of them. So I want to head off anything that could be awry to give those guys, where they spend most of the time, a comfortable space. So, shoot.
I was just wondering how effective an overhead, you know, like a kitchen range hood is for drawing CO2 out. I mean, I can picture that as much as falling as it is going out.
Yeah. Let me see if I can. Hang on one. Let's see. It's going to be easier to explain with the. Where is that slide? Okay, so this type of situation where I've got my canopy hood over top of it. Canopy hoods do very, very poor at capturing things. As I said, our ability to reach out with the ventilation system and grab a hazard and draw it in is very difficult. The canopy hood, typical of this, is really its best efficiency is in something that's hot. Over top your boil kettle, if you want to get the steam and the heat and everything away, canopy hood's probably a good way to look at it. For your general blow-off bucket in a cellar system, it does not have the ability to reach out and grab it. You want to get in closer to that source of generation. So, Mike, we had another comment here. We want to share a network.
Yeah, we've had a lot of these situations where we've solved them, and because, like you say, it doesn't pull it out. But if you put a ring and you blow air, what you do is you actually capture it and blow it up.
Okay.
And then you suck it out.
Okay, it was called a push-pull system.
You can even lower the exhaust ventilation to a third of what you're having otherwise.
Yeah, so.
So you're saving money also.
Yeah. I still go back to my first choice really is it's closer you can capture. You could put a hood around your typical 5-gallon bucket that we bubble off to a lot of times. You could make a little enclosure around that and then put your exhaust ventilation for that point. So you've made a little enclosure for it. That would be much more efficient. So, questions?
You touched a little earlier on sealed cold rooms and, you know, potential leaks there. Is there really a good way to mitigate the CO2 risk, sort of just opening the door and putting a fan at the floor to get it out?
No. Your mitigation there is going back to the fact I want to manage it. Are my lines good? Do I have a sensor technology in that space? In your sensor technology, you want your alarm on the outside of the cooler door? That's before I enter it, so it really goes back to all those things. Am I got good preventive maintenance? Do I have good training and education? Am I sure when I tap my kegs, those are locked down properly every time? Can you turn off the CO2 on the lines you're not using? Again, anything to reduce that risk, but it's going to come back to SOPs, procedures, and sensors or monitoring. If you guys are done, I'm gone. We're right on schedule. I think there's another reception and other things to go to. And the vendor hall, I think, is open for a little bit more. So thank you.
Slightly off topic question for you. How do you...